In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to hour number two of the program for Friday, November 5th, 2010 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And as we do every Friday at 2 o'clock, it's time for the Federal News Countdown. Two experts from the federal government choose the news stories they think are the most important to people who work for the federal government, rank them in order, and count them down from number three all the way to number one. And no exception this week, and I have two terrific federal experts to welcome to the Federal News Countdown this week. Stan Soloway, president of the Professional Services Council. Nice to see you again, my friend.
Francis, always a pleasure.
Good to have you back on the show. And Tim McManus, Vice President for Education and Outreach at the Partnership for Public Service. Nice to see you again, Tim.
Francis, great to be here.
This is a good week to be on the Federal News Countdown. A lot going on. I kept thinking that we would get to late October, November, into December, and things might slow down around holiday time, and nothing could be further from the truth. A lot going on, and we will not waste any time. Right to
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to Stan Soloway, is from Maclean's, the news magazine from Canada, and the headline is "The Trouble with Security: Leaked Military Documents Reignite the Debate Over Hiring Private Security Firms in Iraq and Afghanistan." This is the WikiLeaks controversy, kind of meshed with the private security contractors controversy.
It is to a certain extent. And McLean's had this extensive story. I think the real story, I wasn't really even intending to get into the relative veracity of the WikiLeaks or the various documents, but really the decision by President Karzai in Afghanistan to terminate all of the private security contractors in Afghanistan, originally mid-December, now it's been pushed to March, may seem like an odd story relative to the federal workforce, but what it really could do for the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department is effectively shut down one of the key elements of our efforts in Afghanistan, which is development.
Mm-hmm.
These are not folks who are doing military work. These are folks who are out there doing economic, healthcare, education, and all kinds of development work. They're development professionals. They're NGOs. They're companies. And if you don't have security, you don't have development.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no alternative. The alternative, President Karzai has suggested, that the Afghan National Police and the security forces be the security. All you had to do was read the paper the other day in the Washington Post and the New York Times, a story about 20 security folks walking out and literally shutting down an Afghan police station and defecting to the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
The entire station in one morning just left.
Yeah.
It's not in my view here, a debate about how you govern, utilize, or otherwise monitor the use of private security, but the impact is on the mission of the U.S. Agency for International Development, which the administration has placed a great deal of emphasis on building our development presence and capabilities, and this could actually have an enormous impact. And then you, of course, have a number of companies and also federal employees who work for aid and state who would be affected by this.
Well, that you get to what I was going to ask you about, and that is, not only is it the idea that state and USAID employees wouldn't be protected, but that contracting companies that are going to do that work wouldn't maybe not even be willing to bid on these jobs, understanding that their people wouldn't necessarily be safe.
President Karzai has actually exempted diplomatic corps. So if you're an employee of aid or state, presumably you can still have security. There is an exemption that he's in his decree. But a lot of the firms that are, and these are very small companies, they're very large, there are a number of NGOs, have pretty much made it clear, if we don't have security, we can't do the work. And it's not a question of whether they choose to bid. Many of them would, for security reasons, not.
Mm-hmm.
But under U.S. law, if you're doing a contract for the federal government anywhere outside of the United States, you have to provide a certain degree of insurance. It's called the Defense Base Act. And the insurers have basically said there's no way we can insure people unless there's a real security presence. So this is a little apart from the debate over whether we don't have private security. This gets to the guts of what USAID and the State Department's trying to accomplish in Afghanistan. There are negotiations and discussions continuing, but it could have an enormous impact on a major part of the administration's agenda overseas.
And this is complicated even more by the fact that we're not even sure, at least publicly, how effective Karzai is, how strong his hold on power is in the first place.
Well, there's all kinds of dynamics. And I think, obviously, one of our major efforts in Afghanistan is to train the Afghan security forces. And they're clearly not, in terms of numbers and capability, ready to do their own security, let alone provide the security for literally thousands of development and reconstruction projects around the country. So what happens if you don't have that capability and we're not getting the water systems built, we're not helping with the schools and doing the things, the soft power projection that is such a key element of what the administration is trying to accomplish? And I think General Petraeus has been very clear that if we can't do that, it pretty much obviates a key part of his strategy.
Mm-hmm. Stan Soloway, story number three on the Federal News Countdown is from McLean's. The headline is The Trouble with Security, and you can find it linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Tim McManus, your story number three is from The Post, and the headline is Federal Salaries Fall Further Behind Public Sector, New Data Show. And this is just an ongoing debate. There are two sides to the story, and sometimes the sides seem more like they're talking past each other than talking to each other. What's the crux of this salary debate as you see it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One, Francis, as you said, this story isn't going away anytime soon. But some new data released this week by the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that salaries of federal workers are actually slightly further behind their private sector counterparts. And again, there's another camp that will say that's exactly not the case, that they're well ahead. I think part of the conversation here is really looking apples to apples, and that doesn't seem to be the case in these different sets of data that folks are looking at in terms of figuring out whether or not they're correct or not. I think one of the really interesting things in this story is if you look at certainly salaries of federal employees is going to be somewhat driven by location that they're in. Locality pay comes into play there, and locality pay frankly comes into play in the private sector as well. It's called market. Market-driven. I think that's going to be a lot of the conversation on this story moving forward is it time to look at more of a market-driven salary structure for federal employees? You look here in the Washington-Baltimore area right now, and based on the BLS statistics that were just released, you know, we're 38% behind the private sector in this area. That's for all your listeners, that's a pretty wide margin.
That's a big chunk, yeah, yeah. Is there a way to do that, though? You're talking about market-based being looking at each individual rather than just having a set number for locality pay, having somebody who's involved in these markets and immersed in them helping to determine what a fair pay rate is. Is there a way to do that efficiently, to collect that information efficiently, or is this going to be a pretty difficult
operation?
Yeah, Francis,
I think that's actually at the heart of some of this conversation and the two sides of this conversation that are saying, are federal workers overpaid, are federal workers underpaid, if you just take an occupation and you say a radio broadcaster for government or a radio broadcaster for the private sector, well, if you've been a radio broadcaster for 40 years in the federal government, your pay is probably on average going to be higher than the salary of somebody who's been in radio broadcasting in the private sector for 5 years. So mm-hmm. that isn't actually, you've got to look at all of those various factors. And again, I think your initial point about these two sides talking past each other mm-hmm. is actually where really some of the confusion has come in, is that conversation hasn't gotten to the granularity that it really needs to in order to say, what's the tenure of these folks? And not only what's the tenure and location of these folks, but also, experience level as a whole. All of those things have to be wrapped in here. I don't think there's an easy answer to it.
Because I've seen elements of every single one of these stories, no matter which side they come down on, that as somebody who pays a little bit of attention to this stuff, say, yeah, that I happen to know that is actually the case, and yet we still continue to have these series come out and over again.
I think that this is we're going to talk about this more with regard to other stories that both Tim and I identified for the week, but I just want to make a couple of points. One is that the story also identified the fact that the gap is greater with the higher-skilled versus lower-skilled employees. If you look at the federal government's needs, it's higher-skilled employees. Mm-hmm. It increased professionalization, technology skills, and so forth. And so the gap is worst at the place where the government most needs people. The second thing is to be the other side of the coin is what we have seen in a number of agencies, particularly at DOD, is efforts to hire contractor employees who presumably are higher paid by offering pay increases and most significantly signing bonuses. What happens, though, in the federal system is the signing bonus gets amortized effectively over a couple of years because it makes you from a 14 to a 15 if you get that kind of bonus. And there aren't going to be any pay raises coming behind that. So we're not going to be able to hold those people.
Mm-hmm.
So this sort of short-term illusory building of the workforce, so I'm going to just grab Joe, offer him a pay increase, and $10,000 pay increase, and a signing bonus cannot hold, particularly when the economy starts coming back. So mm-hmm. I think Tim's exactly right. You got to come back to square one and look at the whole structure. Otherwise, the government's never going to be able to compete for the kind of people it really needs.
Tim McManus's story number three in the Federal News Countdown is headlined, Federal Salaries Fall Further Behind the Public Sector, New Data Show. And it's a story from the Washington Post, linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Story number two from Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council, when In-Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
There's no better way to study the world's best golf swings than to watch them side by side on the range. Move down the line from Arnold Palmer to Fred Couples to Phil Mickelson, and you notice not just the differences, but the similarities, like their wonderful balance, rhythm, and timing. And if you look closely as they leave, you'll notice something else they have in common. The same timepiece, a Rolex Day-Date. Available in 18-karat white or yellow gold or platinum, the Day-Date is put through 15 days and nights of the most grueling testing before it ever leaves Geneva. That ensures that, like these great golfers, it will perform as well in the real world as it does in practice. To see a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
I'm not just some tall drink of water, you know. I mean, I wash your dishes, I do the laundry, I help put out fires. I'm always there when you need me. 24/7, at home, at work, just about anywhere. And I'm not expensive, but I have great taste. Well, I guess I am a tall drink of water, but I'm tap water, and that makes me special. For more information about what only tap water delivers, visit drinktap.org.
What's the buzz in the federal community? Chris Dorbeck knows it. Join Chris for the Dorbeck Insider, weekday afternoons 3 to 7 on Federal News Radio AM. Chris has the insights on who's coming and who's going, new memos, new contracts, fun and helpful ways for federal managers to improve agency productivity while meeting mission goals. The Dorbeck Insider, building federal community by connecting people. Weekday afternoons on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
We're back on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service, my federal experts, counting down the top stories of the week this week. And we're up to
number two.
Second most important federal news story of the week, according to Stan Soloway, is from the Federal Times. The headline is, Clapper promises thought will go into intelligence contract cuts. And those two words right next to each other, I know, are words that you don't like to see together. Contract cuts, right, Stan?
Well, it's not my favorite thing, but I would not suggest that there's never necessary. So it's not that hard line.
Okay. What did you take away from this when you learned about the new DNI, James Clapper, talking about what will happen with the contracts?
I don't think anybody's surprised that the DNI, the current or his predecessors, all looked at this question on the role of service contracts at DNI and throughout the intel community and how best to manage it and so forth. I actually took away from it an issue completely related. It's a perfect segue from Tim's point, and that is, how do you actually manage this environment?
Mm-hmm.
The Intel community probably has the best grasp of all the communities on what they've actually contracted for. They did some really deep dives when their former chief human capital officer was there, and Ron Sanders, and they really kind of have a good understanding. And the relation to Tim's comment is directly also related to this question that Clapper's raised, which is, what they assessed effectively, or in essence, was that about half of the contractors supporting the intel community are doing fairly routine support services.
Mm-hmm.
And the other half are typically specialized high-end skills, the very kinds of skills that the government typically does not compete well for in the marketplace, particularly in this area. But if you think about things like people who are experts in algorithmic math or predictive math and so forth, the financial services community, the insurance industries, the utility, everybody's looking for those kinds of skills, and they're in very short supply. And what Ron Sanders, when he was the Chico there, concluded was, and what the DNI concluded, is they're never going to be able to compete for large numbers of those folks. So the mm-hmm. idea is, and I think this is partly what Clapper's talking to, is making sure they have at least a core capability in that area without even thinking about trying to do it all organically.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be a relatively narrow band. Then you get to the other 50%, and that just becomes really the kind of assessment we ought to be doing of contracts as well as everything else we do organically or otherwise, which is, what are we doing we don't need to do anymore?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we doing it efficiently? Are we doing it right? And I think that's really where he's focusing, and that's why he says it's going to take several years to implement it. But if you look at the numbers around Intel, and this is, again, their numbers from when Ron Sanders was the Chico, they actually leveled out and began reducing the number of contracts and amount of contracting dollars over the last several years as a result of this earlier analysis. So it's kind of two pieces. One is, how do you get those critical skills in? Because if you don't have people who understand the stuff, how do they manage the outside providers and oversee it and control the mission? And then how do you make sure that you have the right efficiencies in the other side where you have more routine, everything from IT systems or network support to lawn mowing and food service. I mean, that's kind of that routinized area. And I think what I take away from it is Clapper's talk about this several-year effort will really means that they are approaching it pretty strategically, which is what they've done over the last several years. They're kind of ahead of the rest of this community around this.
Some best practices here for other agencies to learn from.
Yeah, I think the Intel community actually has been ahead of the curve on this for a while. Mike Hayden, the former head of the CIA, several years ago said we need to reduce contracting by 10%. Part of it was just do it smarter.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of fluff in the process, not the contracts, but just the whole process and the requirements. I think that's a very smart and effective thing to do, and I take away that that's where Clapper's headed.
Your mention of Ron Sanders reminds me that all of these threads tie together, because your colleague on the countdown this week is Tim McManus from the Partnership for Public Service. They have a study that came out yesterday. Ron was on the Federal Drive with Tom and Amy yesterday talking about that study, and he's going to expand on that on In-Depth Francis Rose on Monday. He'll be in studio with me to talk about that. Tim, this kind of precise evaluation, rather than just saying we're going to cut this much and do this much, that's the kind of thing that your group is talking about all the time.
I think this is going to be a theme of the rest of the 40 minutes of this show as well, Francis, which is, you know, in the environment that we're operating in here now, which is reduce budgets, cut spending, there's a lot of different ways you can do that. OD&I seems to be on the right path here, which is not simply we're going to cut contracts and we're going to cut expenses, but we're actually going to do this smartly. We're going to take a scalpel to it and figure out where we can do that and recognize that it's not simply cutting contracts here, but you've got to actually have the right people in place to manage those contracts. You've got to have a structure in place that's going to facilitate that, and all of that will enable you to make the smart cuts, not simply to reduce spending.
Mm-hmm.
If this is an exercise of reducing spending for the sake of reducing spending, we're probably in a world hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I was just on that point, to take it out of the Intel space. I spoke to an Air Force acquisition audience on Tuesday out in Colorado, and I posed the question to them because Secretary Gates has talked about reducing contracting, increasing efficiency and so forth, and he's looking at 10% or whatever the number might be in certain areas. And so I took a poll of probably 300 people there. I said, just show of hands, how many of you think if you sat down with your contractors and really had a collaborative process, you could find 10-15% fluff in the system, just unnecessary process requirements that aren't needed and all that kind of stuff? A whole bunch of hands went up.
Mm-hmm.
I said, okay, the second question is, how many of you think you're going to be empowered to actually go do that? And I didn't see a lot of hands.
The story number two from Stan Soloway on the Federal News Countdown this week is from the Federal Times. The headline is Clapper Promises Thought Will Go Into Intelligence Contract Cuts. And you can read that story and all of the stories on our countdown this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Tim McManus is story number two on the countdown when we continue on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
NBC News Radio, I'm Luke Russert on Capitol Hill. In breaking news, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has announced she will run for minority leader in the new Republican-run House of Representatives. The first female speaker says she will try to keep her Democratic leadership post despite the massive election losses in her party. Not good enough. That was President Obama's reaction to good news from the Labor Department today, a report showing the strongest job creation in 5 months.
I am open to any idea, any proposal, any way we can get the economy growing faster so that people who need work can find it faster.
There is a gain of 151,000 jobs in October, not enough to budge the unemployment rate, still at 9.6%. The president is now winging his way to Asia for a 10-day trip. The itinerary includes meetings in India and Indonesia, a G20 summit in South Korea, and an economic forum in Japan. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Luke Russert, NBC News Radio.
Right now at the Home Depot, trade in a string of old Christmas lights, working or not, and get $3 off a brand new string of LED Christmas lights. Choose from a wide selection and keep them on longer without having your electric bill be any higher. We're lowering the cost of keeping Christmas on with $3 off LED holiday lights. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. Valid in U.S. only through November 14th while supplies last. Limit 5 per person. See store for details.
There are big things happening at JCPenney's biggest sale of them all. This Friday and Saturday, we're bursting with deals. Save big across the store, starting with 50% off coats for you and for the family. And 50 to 60% off our entire stock of sheet sets. Plus, with JCP Cash, you'll get $10 back on the spot when you spend 50, 15 when you spend 75, and a big $20 back when you spend 100. See you Saturday at 7. Shop JCP.com. New look, new day, who knew? JCPenney. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Offers end November 6th.
You should never be constrained by your network. That's why government agencies turn to Avaya Government Solutions and Ronco. Their data networking portfolio offers reliable, secure, end-to-end solutions needed to fully recognize the power of real-time communications. Solutions from Avaya and Ronco deliver innovative technology, energy-efficient hardware, and improve the effectiveness of business by creating a simpler, more effective network. The future of data networking has arrived. Learn more at avayagov.com/GSA2010. Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on Federal News Radio. Visit MyVillageGreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Enzymatic Therapy and Nordic Naturals.
Plan now to attend Affirm's breakfast briefing on government innovators, catalysts for change. It features our very own Francis Rose Thursday, November 18th at the Washington Court Hotel in downtown D.C. You'll dialogue with speakers as Affirm explores how newly emerging technologies are transforming government. Register today for a timely and informative discussion. Go to Affirm.org to register. That's Affirm.org.
We're back on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on the countdown this week, Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council and Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service. And Tim, your story number two this week is from The Post. The headline is Federal Hiring Changes Bring Hope and Skepticism for the Application Process. And this is an issue that we heard Nancy Kichak talk about, and Ed references a panel that he moderated at ELC last week that we had highlights of on the program this week. Some people are optimistic. Some people are apprehensive, and when you get optimism and apprehension together in government, it doesn't always result in a whole lot of activity necessarily.
Yeah, clearly an issue that the partnership is passionate about. In 2002, when we launched our Call to Serve initiative to bring federal agencies and colleges and universities together, federal hiring reform the federal hiring process was at the crux of that, is that you've got to reduce some of the barriers or eliminate some of the barriers to applicants actually seeking pathways into federal service. I think, we've been intimately involved in these conversations with the administration, with OPM. I think, Francis, your point about those who are apprehensive about it, that's actually the most difficult challenge here. There's two types of changes that have to take place in order for hiring reform really to take effect. One is really on the technical level. How do you go from simply no longer assessing based on lengthy essay questions to assessing on a resume? That frankly, at its core, is a very technical change that needs to be made.
Mm-hmm.
But if you peel back layers, Francis, here's where it gets tricky, is we've been doing this for a heck of a long time. How do we now evaluate that? Or what's worked for me before, it's worked for me before, yeah. I'm not sure so there's the technical aspect of it, but then there's the heart and soul piece of it that says, I'm not letting go of this anytime
soon.
Yeah,
it's the between the ears emotional end of it that goes far beyond and is much more difficult to change than changing regulations or rules or requirements or whatever.
It's not terribly different than the challenges agencies, particularly DOD and others, have had as they've tried to implement alternative personnel systems where there's actual pay-for-performance processing, leaving the politics outside of it. One of the major complaints from the unions and others has been that the management level has done it a certain way for years, and they're not really trained and experienced in how to evaluate people. That would affect how you hire people. It also affects how you evaluate their performance and reward them. I mean, it's all part of this mentality we have that is very sort of cut and paste, push the button, and we haven't developed a workforce that's really good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Stan, and what we have developed is a culture as well that says this is an HR issue.
Yeah,
hiring,
exactly.
Recruiting is an HR issue.
Right.
Yet those that have the most to gain and lose are actually not HR. It's the hiring managers. It's the supervisors and managers in federal government. So, you know, on the optimistic side of things, I think there are some bright spots to point to. The time to hire in the federal government is being reduced. The presidential memo of May 11th says 80 days. Well, across government right now, we're probably at about 110, 115 days. That's down substantially from where it was even 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
John Berry on Monday stood up in front of a crowd and said 100% of OPM's announcements are now 3 pages or less. 100% of our announcements now do not require KSAs. They require only a resume and a cover letter. If we can do it, everyone else can. I think, again, there are agencies that are doing it. There, quite frankly, are agencies that were doing this long before the May 11th presidential memo as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are still areas of concern, and again, that area of concern is how do you get everybody to pay attention to this in a meaningful way? One of the things that we hear most often, particularly from hiring managers, is I don't have time, and I don't know what engagement or involvement really looks like.
Mm-hmm.
On the time thing, you know, my response has been for a long time now, if you don't take the time now, are you really going to have the time to try to correct what went wrong if you didn't initially invest in this? How are you going to deal? Do you have the time to deal with the poor performer, deal with the person who's in the wrong job to begin with? You've got to invest there. On the what your involvement is, again, I think OPM has actually taken some pretty good steps in that arena. It's a large workforce, though, and if you look at everybody who's making a hiring decision, that's a whole lot of people that you have to reach and get them to change the way that their behaviors and their attitudes.
And you do have to go far beyond, Stan, the idea of saying you just have to start doing it this way and giving people some kind of the emotional case that Tim just made to say this is not just something that you should do because we're telling you to. This is really for your own good.
At the risk of using a hackneyed phrase, what we're really talking about here is change management, which is not something the government ever practices. I mean, you've got to invest the hiring community in this process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are examples of success. DOD, for instance, in the acquisition workforce, has hired 3,500 new acquisition folks to their intern programs. Most of them are interns, I think about 80%. So there are examples. But it does. The other piece is it doesn't stop with the hiring. You've got, first of all, in many cases, particularly for a skilled workforce, even young people, security requirements that can be daunting and scare them. They're not sure quite what they have to admit to and a lot of other stuff and just the process. Then you've got the whole longer question of once I get in, what do I do with these people? How do I manage them? How do I develop them? And that's an area, frankly, and I happen to be a fan of pay for performance. I realize it's been difficult to implement, but that's an area where the government really lags the private sector. And I think one of the steps that has to be tied to this so you can talk to new hires about it is in the government, typically to get into a leadership program or management program, it takes you 5-10 years. In some cases, it can be 12 or 15 years of experience before you qualify.
Mm-hmm.
At a high-performing company, they know they're only going to get you for 2 years to 2.5 years max. That's sort of the average stay.
Right.
By the end of your first year, these are the better companies. They've already figured out who the high performers are, and they are managing them differently.
Mm-hmm.
They are managing them to develop them differently because they don't want to lose them.
Yeah.
Then there's a middle that you'd like to keep, but it's not critical. And then there's the bottom category where you just soon see them leave.
Mm-hmm.
Just how you approach it and be able to communicate that, articulate that to new hires so they feel like they're not just going to get into this. It is a vast bureaucracy. It's an enormous operation. I think it's a big challenge.
That is exactly the element of pay for performance that every time we had a conversation on this station with Mary Lacy, with Brad Bunn, anybody associated with that, what feedback are you getting from the managers, not just from the employees who wanted to be managed differently or better, but the managers who are saying, we want more input, we want more guidance on how we evaluate people and how we do that classification, that categorization as you're talking about, so that we can evaluate, so we can actually do the process, the evaluation process, more accurately, but also how we can make the organization work better from day to day.
And unfortunately, the reaction, this is Tim's issue, I don't mean to dominate, but the reaction has been where we've experimented with that is just to chop it off rather than fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was at the Defense Department, we actually had one of the first pay-for-performance experiments in government. It was congressionally mandated. It was called the Acquisition Workforce Improvement Program.
Mm-hmm.
And we had broadbanding and all kinds of capabilities. And by the second cycle through, we did satisfaction surveys of everybody each year and so forth. We were at about 75% satisfaction, which is about as high as you want to get.
Yeah.
Because you don't want the bottom
you don't want everybody to like it. That's right.
But there was tremendous resistance. It was political and so forth. And there were challenges. I mean, people did not know how to evaluate, but you don't throw it out. And throwing the baby out with the bathwater is rarely the right answer. And that tends to be a sort of either or rather than, okay, how do we use this information to fix it?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess that when you see what's happening, the shortening of the hiring times, overall, you're very pleased with what's going on. What's the next step, though?
Pleased with hiring timeline going down, but also concerned about that as well, is that our agencies and OPM, in fact, putting too much emphasis simply on the time to hire. So you could hire somebody, you know, in 30 days.
And that might be a bum.
And at the end of the day, we're no better off. And in fact, we're in worse shape than we were before.
Yeah.
So I think the real concern moving forward is, you know, how do we actively engage everybody? And Stan said it in one of our earlier conversations here about collaboration. And that's really what it is here is folks within agencies, HR, non-HR folks have to collaborate, figure out what their roles are, but also know who they can turn to and how they can support each other. And in the end, if they can get that right, and I actually believe that they can, it's going to take some time, but if they can get that right, it's actually going to benefit everybody.
All right. Story number two on the Federal News Countdown from Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service is headlined, Federal Hiring Changes Bring Hope and Skepticism for the Application Process. And it's available now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Back for story number one, when the In-Depth with Francis Rose continues, it's the Federal News Countdown.
Here's Judy Spencer, co-chair, Federal Identity, Credential, and Access Management at GSA, on the Federal Executive Forum on Identity Management, sponsored by SafeNet.
I believe we're going to move away from the smart card as the hardware token. I see mobile phones coming into their own. I actually believe that in the very near future, there will be an app for that. And it will be my identity credential somehow or other linked into my phone as the hardware token that carries it around.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
From defending our nation's borders to protecting the environment, cloud computing services can support your mission and serve the American public. Trust your information in the cloud with SafeNet's data-centric solutions that enable security, privacy, and compliance. SafeNet Solutions allows agencies to share sensitive data throughout the information lifecycle. From the battle space to the White House, SafeNet has been at the core of data protection for more than 25 years. Visit safenet-inc.com/government.
Newsmakers on the Dora Beck Insider.
Tom Trabuco, he is the Director of External Affairs at the Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board.
Since the measurement on contributions to 401ks and the TSP is similar to the measurement used to determine an increase in Social Security benefits, and those have already been determined to not have an increase, I would be very surprised if there were an increase in the IRS limits this year.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Dora Beck Insider.
We're back on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on the countdown, choosing the most important federal news stories of the week, are Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council. And for the second week in a row, a bit of an oddity. Both gentlemen have chosen news stories about the same subject, and it wasn't really hard to predict with the elections happening this week. Yeah, yeah. Nobody's surprised by this. Both of the stories chosen as number one by both of my guests revolve around the election. Stan, you chose the Washington Post story headlined, White House and Congress Poised for a Battle Over Tax Breaks in the Lame Duck Session. And Tim, your story is Mike Causey's column titled, Pay Freeze and Job Cuts and Furloughs, Oh My. But both of them revolve around the impact that the election has and will have on the federal workforce and the way that the agencies do business. Let's flash back, if we can, to about 11 o'clock on Tuesday night when you were watching election returns come in. Professionally, Tim, what were you thinking about as you were watching the results happen then, and how it might affect the things that you care about at your job.
Yeah, I think by 11 o'clock, I think it was already a foregone conclusion, and maybe even going into Tuesday, a little bit of a foregone conclusion. But I think that was one of the most striking things about Mike's column, is several of the same thing issues that he raised in that column were exactly what was going on in my head. We're already, you know, in a battle right now to try to get people to really recognize people, you know, both average Americans as well as Congress, the administration, everyone, to understand the value of federal employees and the type of work that they do on behalf of all of us. And I think in this environment, it just became a whole lot more difficult to do that. Mike's title for his column, I think, strikes exactly to what was going on in my head as well at that time.
Mm-hmm. What were you thinking about at that time, Stan? having to do with the election only.
No, I got you. I there were a lot of thoughts going through my mind, but with regard to where I sit professionally, it was we're headed into some serious chaos, and it's not a judgment politically one way or the other. I think, let me start with what Tim was talking about and Mike's column. I think he's absolutely right. You have already had talk about pay freezes and hiring freezes and so forth, and you look at any agency of the federal government, particularly in the skilled workforce levels and the gaps that they have now that they're trying to hire to fill. I don't happen to be a big fan of either arbitrary FTE ceilings or pay freezes. Pay freezes or hiring freezes, or any more than I think it's smart to just say, oh, we'll just contract for everything. I think you got to have a reasoned strategic process. And so that was part of it. I think the second piece, that I was thinking about, and it relates also to Mike's column to a certain extent, is we have a government that's operating under a continuing resolution right now. Most civilian agencies have been under continuing resolutions year over year over year. We haven't had a full appropriations process, 3 or 4 years or whatever it's been.
Mm-hmm.
That creates enormous pressure on the agencies and on their workforces, and obviously derivatively on the contractor community supporting them. Everything gets pushed to the right. The battle over scraps of money are fierce. Now we're looking at a lame duck session, and the critical question for the agencies immediately is, will they do a short-term or a long-term CR?
Mm-hmm.
Will we fund the rest of the government, or will we kick the can down the road to the end of January? And frankly, the indications we're getting right now are the most likely outcome is going to be a short-term CR through the end of January, early February, which means you're February, March before you get fully funded. You're
yep.
essentially halfway through the year. How are you supposed to efficiently run a federal agency? And I think the public tends to be, in all honesty, a little schizophrenic about government. They don't like, quote, big government, but what are you not going to do for the public?
Mm-hmm.
And what services get cut? Look
yeah.
at the states that have cut services and the political price their governors pay.
Well, and look at a country like England that is cutting
exactly where I was going next is following that, getting into the longer-term picture, the next year and the year after, what does austerity look like? And
mm-hmm.
what is the impact on agencies? So as I look at the civilian side of the house, most civilian agencies have been under incredible budget pressures for years. They're hanging on by a thread. Now, if you had a long strategic process where you really, again, like we talked about earlier, really went through what are we doing? What do we don't need to be doing anymore? Are there ways, the areas we can cut back? It takes a long time. It's not something the government's particularly good at. But if we did that, you could probably identify some budgetary savings.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that kind of time horizon. You have the 2012 elections started at 8 o'clock Tuesday night.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be necessity on both sides of the aisle to demonstrate capability to govern and change and so forth. So I think the pressures on the agencies from a fiscal perspective are going to get greater. And we could be seeing there are a couple of proposals. One, the Pledge for America, the Republican Pledge for America, talks about returning funding levels to the FY 08 levels. Talk to a number of folks on the Republican side. They're serious about fiscal. They're not sure that's doable. I don't know how you actually do that, particularly for the national, for DOD and Homeland and agencies that are had regular appropriations on and off for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
There is very likely going to be some sort of rescissions. Where are the rescissions going to come? Are they going to be strategic? To use Tim's comment earlier, is it a scalpel or is it a hatchet?
Yeah.
And I'm not making that as a political statement. That's the sort of political reality when a new party comes in, got to show the flag pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The one interesting twist on this, I mean, there's one flip side that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, is that Eric Cantor, who presumably will be the number two Republican in the House, does have a legislative proposal that would effectively prohibit government shutdowns. In the event that there is loggerheads over appropriations, you would have a sort of an automatic kind of rolling dollar flow to keep people working, keep the government functioning, which would be helpful. But I think the key point here is, again, apolitically, regardless of which party one's in, is we are looking at a fiscal battle that's going to get fierce and fiercer. And there's going to be fiscal debates within the caucus of each party as well. There are clearly within the Republican Party and within the Democratic Party different camps. And so I think sorting all that out is going to be tough.
You used a word that I think applies a lot more than people think it does. The word chaos is usually used as hyperbole. But I was on with Chris Dorabeck earlier in the week on the Dorabeck Insider talking about reactions to the election. And I think it, when it comes to oversight and looking at how these agencies are doing business, how they're hiring people, what they're doing, the potential for chaos is great, if only because, especially on the Democratic side, the amount of just history, the amount of experience that's gone. I mean, you look at the House Armed Services Committee, the top four Democrats, the four most experienced Democrats on the House Armed Services Committee are gone. And they're not coming back.
Well, it's another good example of the incredible power, frankly, of the staff on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a committee like the Armed Services Committee typically has a professional staff that stays. In this case, it's not clear to me that all of them will stay because staff that, well, their patrons are gone, but they may get hired by the minority, you know, as they, you know, whoever becomes the ranking members. But some of them are senior enough that they may decide this is not an environment they want to stay in. Let me give you one other example on the other side. Senate Appropriations Committee, Foreign Operations Appropriators. This is state and USAID. Again, another state USAID example.
Mm-hmm.
All of the Republicans on that subcommittee retired.
Mm.
So there is an experience loss issue, and it comes back to whether chaos is the right word. It raises the question, how do you hit the ground running when you've got potentially a current year budget to get done, the president's budget coming up, and a bunch of other stuff happening? So I think that it creates a certain amount of uncertainty. And again, I'm not making a political judgment on the elections, just sort of what we think is going to evolve.
Tim, during the break, I want you to think about the direct impact this will have on the workforce, the elections will have, and we'll talk about that when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the number one story of the week as chosen by both Tim McManus and Stan Soloway on the Federal News Countdown this week on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, revolves around the election on Tuesday and the impact it'll have on the way the government does business. Tim's story from federalnewsradio.com and Stan's story from the Washington Post, both posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
The Pentagon and Beyond, brought to you by Airink.
The Air Force is planning to develop more high-tech drones that can collect intelligence and better maneuver in the combat airspace, according to the Associated Press. The Air Force has already dramatically increased the number of armed and unarmed drones over Afghanistan and Iraq. Air Force Lieutenant General Philip Breedlove says there are growing worries, and the U.S. needs aircraft that can better gather information and conduct electronic attacks. I'm J.J. Green.
Can you imagine being responsible for the electronic security of up to 1 billion barrels of emergency crude oil stored in salt caverns as deep as 4,000 feet? Airink can. Their advanced information management platform protects over $80 billion worth of crude oil for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The stockpile is so important to our national security that there's only one person in the world who can authorize its drawdown. For more information, log on to arinc.com.
Hi, I'm Neil Asbury, host of The Neil Asbury Show. Please join me and my guests each week as we discuss the importance of international trade, entrepreneurialism, small business ownership, job creation, and the American dream.
The Neil Asbury Show, Saturday mornings at 8 on Federal News Radio. The Neil Asbury Show is sponsored by AIT Worldwide Logistics, Yoakum Shore and Trossaven, and WTS Withers Worldwide Transportation Systems.
Plan now to attend a firm's breakfast briefing on government innovators, catalysts for change. It features our very own Francis Rose, Thursday, November 18th at the Washington Court Hotel in downtown D.C. You'll dialogue with speakers as a firm explores how newly emerging technologies are transforming government. Register today for a timely and informative discussion. Go to affirm.org to register. That's affirm.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown, and Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Stan Soloway of the Professional Services Council are my guests on the Federal News Countdown this week, and both of them choosing stories as their number one story of the week, revolving around how the government does business and how that will be affected by the elections on Tuesday. Tim, as we have a couple of days now to kind of reflect on what has happened specifically, and Mike Causey's column, the story that you chose, digs into this a little bit. We still aren't really sure how this election might affect the federal workforce, are we?
No, we aren't. And I think I just wrote down one word, and I think that encapsulates the feelings of most federal workers at this point, which is uncertainty, complete uncertainty. Does the change in the House mean that my salary is going to be frozen? Does it in fact mean that I may not have a job, that job cuts are in? Does it mean that I'm going to have a job, but frankly, I'm going to be required to do even more than I did before because while I may have a job, the person sitting next to me may not, or I have a job, but I don't actually have any funds to actually do what I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot of questions, and again, the key word that I'd throw out there is uncertainty.
You go back to Tim's comment earlier in the program when we were talking about the hiring process. And the reduction of the hiring process and talking to hiring managers about take the time to do it now.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't hire more hiring managers, you're not going to have the time to do it. Your caseload is going to be overwhelming, and that inhibits you from doing things smartly.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at various efforts Vivek Kundra has underway, like data center consolidation, which is already struggling financially, if there's not more money, how does that get pushed to the right? I think actually the pay freeze issue is an interesting one because it would not have surprised me had the elections turned out differently. That we would have to see a pay freeze, even with a Democrat Congress and administration, just because of the sheer magnitude of the deficit. And it unfortunately is often a way that they kind of wave the flag and say, okay, this is what we're doing on the federal side. But I think Tim's exactly right. For everybody, there's this massive uncertainty. And I think it all comes down to how much time is taken to think through how to implement the various things in the Pledge for America. Again, whether one agrees with it or not, that is now kind of the operational campaign document, if you will. So elements of it are going to be a reality. The question is, how are they implemented?
Well, but are elements of it really going to be reality? Because it doesn't matter who's in power in the Senate. If you can't get 60 votes, you get just about nothing done. So the new Republican majority in the House can do just about anything they want. And it's very unlikely it would get through a conference in the Senate. And if it does, by some miracle, President Obama's sitting there waiting to veto it.
Yeah, well, look, gridlock is the term a lot of people are using.
Yeah.
That they predict gridlock. We could be optimistic and look at it a different way, which is, and some folks have said that politically, this kind of outcome might be the best thing that could have happened to the president because he now has kind of a foil to work with or against.
Same thing that happened to President Clinton.
This is exactly right. What happened to President Clinton. As Tom Davis made the comment the other day that, he got elected because of President Clinton and lost his majority and gave President Clinton a second term.
Yeah.
Or gained the majority and gave President Clinton a second term. So optimistically, it would seem to be the only choice you have is to figure out how to get something done because as Tom Davis, Jim Walsh, other former Republican members of Congress have said very openly, Haley Barbour said this on the news the other night, the former RNC chairman, governor of Mississippi, this is not necessarily an endorsement of the Republican Party. And so both parties have an incentive to try to figure it out. I just am concerned that the uncertainty is a reality that we can't avoid. But we've got an immediate challenge of running government, moving programs forward, moving people forward, whether you're a government employee or contractor supporting the government, and the ability to do that could be a challenge over the next month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Francis, I think all of this creates actually what I would say is really constructive conversation, potentially. If members of the Hill, if the administration actually uses it to that extent. So the conversation about where to make the cuts, if cuts are necessary, that's actually a very constructive conversation, whether it's around pay freezes, pay cuts. Do we insource more things? Do we outsource more things? All what's inherently governmental? Those are actually okay conversations to have, but let's have them deliberately and intentionally. And I think right now where that uncertainty comes in is at least the rhetoric has been we need to slash federal pay. We need to slash the federal workforce. We need to do slash. With no parameters around that, when really there are some parameters already in place. If we say we're going to cut the federal workforce, we've already kind of cordoned off and said, but we're not going to touch the Department of Defense. We've already cordoned off sections and said, but these are untouchable. And that's not unlike what Britain has done in their austerity measures as well. They've cut pretty deeply, but they've also said, here are some areas where we're not going to cut. And by the way, where we are going to cut, it probably takes some other powers in the world to step up and ante up a little bit more. So how do our cuts play into theirs when they're actually slashing defense funding?
We were the first ones to criticize their defense cuts, right? The Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense were very critical of them. There's another piece here, even the insourcing question, which is an interesting one. I don't think it's safe to say that just because it's a Republican majority, it's going to be reflexively pro-business. Yes, there is going to be a focus on regulatory reform, not really in the government contracting area, but I think around some of the regulations that have been controversial in the rules, financial regulation, re-reg, and so forth. But it's not necessarily going to be reflexively pro-business, where the insourcing question, I think, is going to come, and Tim hit on it. Once you've identified and agreed on a definition of what's inherently governmental, the rest of it becomes a fiscal issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so fiscal integrity, fiscal rigor is going to be probably more the theme of the day than it's been to date. And I think that's a discussion that we're going to see evolve.
All right. Just a few more minutes. And I wanted to mention the observation I took away was maybe we can finally get out of – you talked about the CRs, Stan. Maybe we can finally get out of that, at least on the House side, because what better way to prove, as you said, Tim, that things are changing, that potentially things are moving in a more competent, better-managed direction than having budget bills out on time, at least on the House side, where that would at least give the Republicans a chit to go back to the electorate and say, hey, we did our job. We did what we were supposed to do. I don't know that
if they can agree,
if
they can agree on funding levels, if they can agree on where the underlying, and I want to take a lot of time here, but the underlying fiscal issue is not necessarily direct government spending on discretionary programs. Yes, there's always debate about that, and you could make some cuts and save some money. The underlying fiscal issue really is the fact that the federal deficit is about to become dominated by interest on the debt as opposed to spending gap. It's 15% of it today is interest on the debt. According to the administration, by 2015, that'll be 73%, and by 2020, it'll be 90% of the deficit is interest payments. That creates an entirely different set of fiscal pressures.
Unbelievable of numbers when we start to chew on them and think about them. And a fantastic job by both of you on the Federal News Countdown this week. Thank you very much. Tim McManus of the Partnership for Public Service and Stan Soloway, the Professional Services Council. Excellent choices and an excellent conversation that is archived later this afternoon at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth.